Today is Monday, November 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The Trump administration is headed to the Supreme Court.
Justices will hear arguments Monday over whether the Trump administration can remove, for the first time, millions of non-citizens from the population count.
Plus the latest on the conflict in Ethiopia.
Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said an offensive on Mekelle had been successful within a few hours of being launched, and that federal police were now pursuing criminals from the powerful Tigrayan People's Liberation Front.
And some feel-good music to start your week. We'll have these stories and more next. Pennsylvania's highest court has rejected a Republican effort to block the certification of dozens of contests in the state's November 3rd election ballot. The AP's Ben Thomas is up first.
The Pennsylvania Supreme Court threw out a lower court's order halting certification of any remaining contests. In a unanimous decision, the court said the underlying lawsuit was filed months after the expiration of a time limit in Pennsylvania's year-old mail-in voting law that allowed for challenges to it. The Republican plaintiffs had sought to either throw out the 2.5 million mail-in ballots submitted under the law or direct the state's Republican-controlled legislature to pick Pennsylvania's presidential electors. I'm Ben Thomas.
President Trump's lawyers vowed to appeal to the Supreme Court despite the judge's assessment that the campaign's claims have no merit. And U.S. President-elect Joe Biden gained 87 votes in Wisconsin as a partial recount of ballots was completed on Sunday, cementing his 20,000-vote victory over President Trump there. President Trump's attempt to exclude people living in the country illegally from being counted in the 2020 census heads to the Supreme Court on Monday. AP correspondent Mike Hempen takes things from here.
Justices will hear arguments Monday over whether the Trump administration can remove, for the first time, millions of non-citizens from the population count. It's an idea that has been rejected repeatedly by lower courts. But the Trump administration argues that both the Constitution and federal law allow the president to exclude illegal aliens from the apportionment count. The census determines how many seats each state gets in the House of Representatives, as well as the allocation of some federal funding. One of those issues is whether the Census Bureau will be able to meet a year-end deadline for turning in the numbers used for apportionment. A Census Bureau announcement this week that anomalies have been found in the data jeopardizes its ability to hand in the numbers to President Trump by December 31st. It's possible the Senate could agree to extend the deadline, as the House has already done. But if there's no extension, and there's a delay of even 3 weeks, the numbers would be turned over to the Biden administration, which would then have the right to evaluate them and decide whether to use them. Mike Hemp in Washington.
Ethiopia has announced the capture of Tigray's capital, Mekelle, and says that the military operation there is over. But the leader of the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front says they will fight on. Reuters' David Doyle reports.
Ethiopia's government launched a manhunt on Sunday for leaders of a rebellious faction in Tigray. After announcing that federal forces had taken control of the northern region's capital and that the conflict was over. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said an offensive on Mekelle had been successful within a few hours of being launched and that federal police were now pursuing criminals from the powerful Tigrayan People's Liberation Front. But TPLF leader Debretsion Gebremichael says his troops will fight on because this was an issue of, quote, our right to self-determination. Regional diplomats and experts have warned that a rapid military victory might not signal the end of the conflict, and the TPLF has a long history of guerrilla resistance. Thousands are estimated to have died since fighting erupted on November the 4th, and nearly 44,000 have fled to Sudan. In a border camp on Saturday, the UN's High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, said that while refugees are uncomfortable with living in exile, their biggest fear is intercommunal violence when they return.
This is why I think that going forward, it will be important for the government of Ethiopia to reestablish peace, to have a silence of the guns, but also to ensure that there are no retaliation or reprisals between communities, because this is what many have mentioned to me as a primary source of fear.
Six explosions were reported in Asmara, the capital of neighboring Eritrea, on Saturday night, according to the U.S. State Department. It was not immediately clear if they were related to the Tigray conflict, but Tigrayan forces have previously fired rockets into Eritrea, who they accuse of sending troops in support of the Ethiopian military.
Upholding the rule of law.
The conflict has been a major test for Abiy, who took office 2 years ago and is trying to hold together a patchwork of ethnic groups that make up Ethiopia's 115 million people.
David Doyle reports for Reuters News. Protesters have gathered in Bangkok in another of a long series of pro-democracy demonstrations calling for reforms of both the government and the monarchy. AP correspondent Sarah Bassett has that story.
About 1,000 protesters have rallied outside an army base carrying yellow inflatable ducks, a symbol of the demonstrations. The protest movement's core demands are for the Prime Minister and the government to step down, the constitution to be amended to be more democratic, and the monarchy to be reformed to make it more accountable. The calls for reforms to the monarchy are especially controversial, as the institution is seen as virtually untouchable. Thai authorities last week escalated their legal battle against protest leaders. There is concern that if the government feels it cannot control the protests, it may impose martial law or be ousted by the army in a coup. I'm Sarah Bassett.
Iran held a ceremony to mourn prominent nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh on Sunday, days after his killing, which Tehran blames on Israel.
Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar.
Fakhrizadeh has long been suspected by Western and Israeli governments of masterminding a secret nuclear weapons program. He was ambushed on a highway near Tehran Friday and gunned down in his car. A top advisor to Iran's supreme leader has warned that those responsible for killing one of the country's top nuclear scientists would face a calculated and decisive response. To help better understand what this may mean for the region, I spoke with Middle East and North Africa analyst Emily Hawthorne at Stratfor, a RAIN company, via Skype.
I think the big takeaway is that Israel is really accelerating its strategy of trying to weaken Iran's nuclear program, which is something that Israel has done for a long period of time, for many years before now. But I think just over the last year, we've seen an intensified Israeli effort to do so. And I think that that does mean there's a risk of escalation between Israel and Iran, but also a risk of escalation between the U.S. and Iran. And if and when that happens, everyone in the region will get caught in between that. So I think that's why you're seeing a lot of voices in the region, countries like the United Arab Emirates calling for calm, trying to make sure that this situation doesn't turn into an Iranian retaliation that turns into a big tit for tat. But we have to wait and see what happens.
Emily, Iran has blamed Israel for Fakhrizadeh's death and has promised to retaliate. But this is coming in the waning days of the Trump administration and before January 20th, when President-elect Joe Biden will be sworn in. Now, since Biden was part of the Obama administration that crafted the 2015 nuclear deal, does that play into how Tehran responds?
Iran has promised retaliation, and that makes perfect sense, but it could take months and years. And in fact, President Rouhani has called for strategic patience. And other Iranian officials are of course, calling for a swifter response against Israel. But you're going to see this really, this debate within Iran about how to respond, how quickly. You're going to see it play out in the presidential elections in Iran over the next year. And it's really going to determine exactly how that sort of domestic debate is going to determine whether or not Iran and the U.S. can enter any sort of nuclear deal. And that is something that is of interest to every single country in the region, because the primary conflict here is between Iran and Israel. And it's a long-standing, decades-long dispute in the region. But every country in between them and in the broader area, they all are vulnerable to any sort of escalation from that conflict. So everyone is watching and waiting to see whether any de-escalation can happen between those two countries and between Iran and the United States.
Emily Hawthorne monitors political, business, and security developments across the region with a special focus on North Africa and Gulf Cooperation Council member states for Stratfor, a RAIN company. Lisa Schlein reports that UN-mediated talks on drafting a new constitution for Syria get underway Monday, with little prospect of the country's warring parties arriving at an agreement anytime soon.
This coming week, government and opposition delegates of the Syrian Constitutional Committee will meet to thrash out elements of a political document that could pave the way toward national elections in this war-torn country. The UN Special Envoy for Syria, Geir Pedersen, says this process is moving ahead much more slowly than he hoped for, because of mutual distrust between the two opposing parties. He says this is not surprising after 10 years of brutal conflict.
We know that we have not lived up to the expectations of the Syrian people in making the progress that is necessary to end the suffering for the Syrian people. So it is my hope that with the relative calm that we are seeing in Syria now, despite all the daily violations, that it should be possible to focus more heavily on the political process and all the elements of Security Council Resolution 2254.
One of the elements in that resolution calls for UN-supervised elections to be held after the adoption of a constitution. Syria's civil war has killed an estimated 400,000 people and caused 5.6 million to flee as refugees. Another 6.2 million are internally displaced. Pedersen says building trust among the government and opposition negotiators is crucial. Doing so, he says, could open the door to a broader political process and permit discussions to move forward on several important issues.
And one of the obvious issues that we're hoping to make progress on is the file of abductees, detainees, and missing persons. And my hope is that if we can continue to build trust within the Constitutional Committee, that that could have a positive impact also on the other issues, and that then that could play positively back on the work we are doing in the Constitutional Committee.
To a large extent, Pedersen notes that progress depends on the Syrians themselves, but also on having international support for the unfolding political process. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And coming up later,
abundant grass growth during spring has led to increased grass fire risk in parts of New South Wales. However, bushfires are always a risk in any summer.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists working on the Japanese radio astronomy project VERA have found that Earth is 2,000 light-years closer to the Milky Way's galactic center and is orbiting it about 7 kilometers per second faster than thought. Residing near the galactic center is what scientists think is a supermassive black hole called Sagittarius A star. According to the UCLA Galactic Center Group, the giant black hole has a mass 4.6 million times that of the Sun and is about 150 million kilometers in size. Project VERA scientists say not to worry, though. Their findings don't mean Earth is getting ready to be sucked into the black hole. It's just because the data they gathered over 15 years of observations allowed them to create what they call a better model of our Milky Way. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The world has welcomed news over the past months that an effective coronavirus vaccine may become available to the public within months, or even mere weeks. Finding a vaccine against the HIV virus, which has claimed tens of millions of lives since the 1980s, has proven far more difficult. What accounts for the lag, and what does that tell us about the differences between HIV and other viruses, such as influenza and the coronavirus, that makes finding a vaccine so challenging? Ahead of World AIDS Day on Tuesday, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with John Moore. He's a professor of microbiology and immunology at the Weill Cornell Medical School in New York and has been involved in the search for an AIDS vaccine since 1988. Moore began by contrasting the HIV virus with the coronavirus.
Well, they're certainly very different animals. It now appears from the efficacy data that is being accumulated that the coronavirus vaccines will work highly effectively. But the HIV problem remains because it's a much more difficult virus to counter. The technologies that are proving successful for coronavirus won't work anywhere near as well or at all for HIV.
Has there been an ongoing concerted effort to develop an HIV vaccine?
Well, sure. Labs worldwide have been working on HIV vaccines since 1986. So it's not for want of investment or effort or competence. It comes down to the virus. HIV is just that much more difficult by a very, very significant margin.
Tell me more about what the difference is between the HIV virus and other viruses such as influenza and the coronavirus that make it so difficult to beat.
There are multiple factors, but two of them certainly stand out. Virus variation, virus mutation, is absolutely a major issue. The coronavirus is proving to be a static target, which is good, because we don't, at this stage, have to deal with virus variation that affects the ability of the vaccines to induce antibody responses. It's a static target. That is hugely beneficial to vaccine design efforts. We need to modify influenza vaccines every year to keep up with variation in the sequences of influenza viruses. With the coronavirus, we haven't needed to modify the formula at all. On the other hand, HIV is essentially the most variable virus that we've had to try to tackle. The virus mutates essentially daily within each individual, and each of those variations are problematic. You would need to modify the composition of an HIV vaccine every week. So it's just orders of magnitude more difficult.
What's the second major difference?
The second major difference is that over the millennia, these retroviruses have developed ways to shield their vulnerable sites. The vaccines are designed to induce antibodies that take on the vulnerable regions of the virus. And with the coronaviruses, there is one well-identified site of vulnerability that is readily accessible target for the immune system. Well, the equivalent regions on the HIV envelope proteins, the equivalent of the coronavirus spike protein, are shielded. They're shielded by sugars, which are not recognized by the immune system, and instead of sticking out like a protuberance, they're recessed in a cavity, and it makes it much harder for antibodies to get at them. So inducing the right kind of antibodies that will be effective against HIV is just so much more difficult, and all the vaccines that have been tested so far have not been able to accomplish that task.
After decades of hard work and disappointment, are researchers just giving up?
Well, the effort to make an HIV vaccine is certainly ongoing. No one has given up on it. But vaccine development will remain difficult. There's no simple answers to this, and there are approaches now being pursued to better identify the weaknesses on the proteins that we're trying to target and to design protein-based vaccines that are better able to induce the type of antibodies that we want. And there's some highly sophisticated development work going on about this. And there are some large-scale vaccine trials ongoing in Africa. That has not reported its results yet, and let the data speak for themselves when we get the result. But we also have to acknowledge that it's an extremely difficult task, and that alternatives can also make a significant impact in reducing HIV spread globally.
John Moore is a professor of microbiology and immunology at the Weill Cornell Medical School. He was speaking to my colleague, Adam Phillips. Argentine justice officials are investigating the death of soccer star Diego Maradona and have ordered a search of his personal doctor's properties. Maradona died from a heart attack on Wednesday at the age of 60, prompting a global outpouring of emotional tributes. Neurologist Leopoldo Luque told reporters after the searches that he had given investigators all the records of his treatment of Maradona, as well as computers, hard drives, and cell phones. Maradona had suffered a series of medical problems, some due to excesses of drugs and alcohol. He was reportedly near death in 2000 and 2004. Two top U.S. coronavirus experts assured Americans Sunday that vaccines against the pandemic would soon become available, but warned that not taking precautions against the spread of the virus before then could prove disastrous. Elsewhere, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is asking lawmakers to support new tiered restrictions to keep the nation's hospitals from becoming overwhelmed before a vaccine for the coronavirus can be approved and distributed. The new measures would put 99% of the country under the two highest restriction levels when the current rules end on Tuesday. The new restrictions would last about a month. Dave Prowse, the British actor behind the menacing black mask of Star Wars villain Darth Vader, has died at the age of 85. A former bodybuilder turned actor, Prowse's towering stature at almost 2 meters clinched him the role of the instantly recognizable antagonist in the original Star Wars trilogy. A car bomb in Afghanistan's central province of Ghazni killed at least 30 people, according to Afghan security force members. Reuters reporter Edward Buran has the details.
The director of the provincial hospital said 30 bodies and 24 injured people had been transported there, adding that all of the victims were security personnel. The blast targeted a compound of the Public Protection Force, a wing of the Afghan security forces, local officials said. It damaged civilian residences around the compound. Interior Ministry spokesman Tariq Aryan confirmed that there had been a car bomb blast, but didn't provide further information on the target or possible casualties. No one has claimed responsibility for the attack. Afghanistan has seen a spate of car bombings over the last few months, despite talks being underway to negotiate peace with the Taliban.
That was Reuters' Edward Buran. Australia's National Bureau of Meteorology is forecasting the approaching summer to be wet, with an increased risk of floods and tropical cyclones. It is predicting conditions will be wetter and cooler than in recent years, but warns that there is still a risk of brush fires for southern Australia. Phil Mercer has the details.
Australia is used to the extremes of nature. Last summer was scarred by some of the worst fires ever recorded in Australia. This year is expected to be wetter and cooler. The influence of La Niña, the periodic cooling of the ocean surface in parts of the Pacific, is expected to result in more rainfall across much of Australia. The Bureau of Meteorology's Climate Outlook is predicting a greater number of tropical cyclones, and there's a good chance the annual monsoon will start early. Andrew Watkins is the manager of Climate Prediction Services at the Bureau of Meteorology.
In contrast to last summer, wetter than normal conditions are likely across much of the country. This means the chance of widespread flooding is raised in eastern Australia. However, we will still see some heat waves and some fires at times. Abundant grass growth during spring has led to increased grass fire risk in parts of New South Wales. However, bushfires are always a risk in any summer.
The updated summer bushfire outlook from the Bushfire and Natural Hazards Cooperative Research Centre has identified grass fires as the main danger this summer in eastern Australia. There's a warning that regions that suffered from intense bushfires last summer are also at risk of flash flooding, erosion and landslides if there's heavy rain. Summer in Australia starts officially on December 1, but extreme heatwave conditions are expected across much of southeastern and eastern parts of Australia in the coming days. Temperatures in South Australia have reached 47 degrees Celsius. In Queensland, a bushfire has closed Fraser Island, one of Australia's most famous tourist destinations. Visitors and residents have been told they can't leave the World Heritage listed island north of Brisbane. The authorities in Queensland say conditions are expected to worsen over the next few days. 2019 was Australia's hottest and driest year on record. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
One of Sierra Leone's top independent rap and hip-hop artists, Louise Sia Diane Squire, better known as Louise, released her latest single and music video on October 16th. Its positive message and authentic style brings a fresh perspective to Selenian music. Heather Maxwell, the host of Music Time in Africa, caught up with the artist in Freetown last week in a virtual interview to find out more.
Hi, Louise. How are you doing?
I'm okay, Heather. How about you?
I'm doing fine. It looks nice and sunny there in Freetown.
It is nice and sunny out here.
So tell me about your new music video, God Bless. I gotta say, I love it for the fashion. I love it for the beat. So what's the message and motivation behind the song?
The whole message is about perseverance in general. Talking about people that have blessings coming their way, but then notwithstanding the blessings that you have coming your way, you have to actually put in the work, put in the energy. So, you know the line that says, Uda God don't bless, Uda go put and on?
Yeah.
That's saying, God can give you this, but you actually have to go out and work for it. So basically, the whole story is talking about perseverance. It's talking about grace. It's talking about hard work.
You're coming from a lived experience by bringing across this message, right?
Yes. I actually have a BS in agriculture and food sciences. I graduated in February, and the problem is that I dropped out for about 2 years. So basically, the song, yes, it resonates with my life, you know, because being able to take myself out of that and go back to school to get the degree, you know. It wasn't easy, but at the end of the day, I had to persevere and I had it done, you know.
So this message applies to everybody, no matter what you're trying to pursue. It could be music, it could be education, it could be becoming a good parent or staying healthy, whatever, right?
Exactly. You know, the second verse starts like, tribulation tough, na me born Hercules. Tribulation tough, na me born Hercules. He's like the strongest guy. So if I'm saying I'm the mother of the strongest guy, imagine who I am. You get it?
So what about the fashion? Tell me about this.
So basically, I was trying to go for something authentic, something African, you know, showcase our background, showcase what we are about.
So all of the prints are typically Sierra Leonean?
It was a fusion. It's Sierra Leonean and something European, because if you notice, I was wearing a blazer, yeah? A typical Sierra Leonean woman would not wear a blazer, but then it's an Ankara blazer. So, yeah, it's a fusion between the European lifestyle and ours here.
Well, one thing, though, that I think is authentically Sierra Leonean is the beat.
It is. The sound is a fusion of a typical Sierra Leonean style of music called the Bubu style and then the Maringa style. We had these people back in the days that used to do Maringa music. That's like a fusion with the Creole and English Maringa and the Bubu style. The Bubu is basically the flutes that you would hear, the snares and the kicks that you would hear. It's actually interesting. I need to give credit to the producer that did the song because he actually was able to tap into what I wanted. Kudos to Splendid for that one.
Kudos to him. Yeah. He really did capture that because that was...
He did.
That's one of the things I really love about the video is the beat. And it has a real, real strong, authentic flavor.
Yeah.
And you just do it beautifully.
Thank you very much. We try our best out here.
What is next for you? Now you have your bachelor's degree, but I hope you're not going to abandon music.
Oh, no. I cannot, even if I try to.
Thank you, Louise. Thank you so much for joining me today and for creating this great music. And good luck with everything.
Thank you very much, Heather. It was nice talking to you. Thank you for having me.
And that was Louise speaking to my colleague and host of Music Time in Africa, Heather Maxwell. And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a magnificent Monday.